Welcome to Communicate Like You Give a Damn, the podcast. Our guests share their stories and approaches to embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in communications because, I mean, let's be honest, we know the power of language. And language leads to behavior. So thank you. Thank you for joining us in leveling up your communications. I'm your host, Kim Clark, and DEI communications, it's kind of my thing. So let's get into it. Let's learn more about how to communicate like you give a damn. Welcome back, everybody, to Communicate Like You Give a Damn. I'm your host, Kim Clark, and I'm so looking forward to having this conversation because while being a podcast host and interviewing a podcast host, it has this whole level of conversation and quality that I just know that's going to come from this. I've been a fan of this podcast for quite a while. And you're going to get a real kick out of it. Some of you may have been, hopefully, you've been listening to it because this is going to be episode 40-something of Communicate Like You Give a Damn. And they are at 240-something episodes of Dear White Women is the name of the podcast. And we have one of the co-hosts of Dear White Women. Women. Yes. Okay. A few episodes, and I'm really excited to get into talking about what you talk about. You can also talk about your book, of course. But these are the kinds of conversations that we need to have. And Misasha here, who's one of the co-hosts, I told her before we started recording, like, I have Native American heritage, but I have lived a white life. The world sees me as a white woman. I am white representing, and I am a work in progress. So say what needs to be said. And so I'm really looking forward to this conversation because it's a really critical year. And that's one of the reasons I reached out to on the table and helping people learn some language around it. And we're communicators, so we're all about the language and the stories and engaging folks and putting a call to action to our work. So I am so thrilled to have you on Communicate Like You Give a Damn. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself.
First of all, the honor is all mine. I am so excited to be here and have this conversation. My name is Misasha Suzuki Graham, and I am the co-founder of Dear White Women, which is partly the podcast that Kim was talking about, in which we help white women use their privilege to uproot systemic racism without centering themselves in the process. We also have a book by the same title, Dear White Women, Let's Get Uncomfortable Talking About Racism. And besides that, I'm a speaker, writer, and facilitator.
A little bit more than that.
A lawyer as well. I thought I'd stop there for the, okay. Yes, yes. I mean, we can get into all of that. Yeah. Depends how far you want to go. You can go into all of it. Yes. Yes, I'm a lawyer. My mother likes to remind me that I am a lawyer. I do voting rights work right now, redistricting, election protection work. Not in the traditional law firm context anymore, though.
All right. So with all of the things that you have as part of your experiences, what has been your path that has led you to doing the work that you're doing now and the podcast and the book? And yeah, specifically, like, I'm super curious of how you said, this is what I want to do with my time.
Yeah, great question. I think you had to go like all the way back then. So I am, you know, the biracial daughter of a Japanese immigrant father and a white mother. So I think when and I was born in 1977, so it wasn't that many years prior that you were even able to marry interracially legally, right? And so I think given that context, I grew up at a time where there wasn't a lot of biracial people around. Like, it was my brother and, you know, in school there was one other family. And so I think race and identity and talking about that and thinking about that has been a real big part of my experience, right, in America and in Japan and otherwise. And I think part of that was trying to figure out where you belong, because mm-hmm. a lot of you know, being biracial was having people try and put you in a box. And when you didn't fit neatly in that box, I mean, even the census would do that, right? Up until 2000, you couldn't check more than one racial box. And so you have to get really strong in who you are. Every time someone puts you in a box and you feel it's not the right box, then you have to be able to say, like, that's not who I am. And so I think given that, and then given that I was always really concerned about whose stories were getting told. And I think that comes from a place maybe of not having seen my own story told, like not growing up with books where there were characters who looked like me or had families like me. You know, when I found out about the Japanese American incarceration during World War II, that was one of the moments where I was like, you know what, I'm going to go to law school because this was wrong. And I believe that we have to do better. And so that was one of those formative moments where I was like, I've got to figure out a way to tell people's stories or to make sure voices are heard. And it's not just one voice that is always being heard or one narrative that is always being told. So like fast forward, I went to college, I worked in finance in Tokyo for 2 years, which did two things. One, made me really discover that I am never suited for a career in finance. And two, that seriously. And two, that I think HR probably threw a party for me when I left, or threw a party not for me, but for the fact that I was leaving, because I was always in there asking about women, treatment of women, treatment, for treatment. And I think it was a very Japanese corporation, and they were kind of like, why are you asking these questions? You know, we want to give you the standard answers. And I was like, well, that's not good enough. So I don't think I was, you know, really loved by the HR side of that bank for a number of reasons, but I felt like I needed to do what was right, not for me, but for the people who were coming after me. And that was the really important part. So then came back to the US, went to law school, and then, you know, spent a lot of years practicing law, not necessarily the civil rights law that I thought I was going to do going in. I did a lot of cross-border work. I did a lot of pro bono work at the same time, trying to focus on those same groups whose voices weren't being heard, who needed people to represent them. And then two things happened, which really put me on the trajectory of Dear White Women. First of all, I got married and I had children. And, you know, I have boys who are now, I think they would call themselves tweens. I don't know. So they're kind of in this age where, you know, they are moving out of the cute stage into a different stage of their adolescence. one, because I miss the cute stage already. And two, because they are Black, Japanese, and white. And so the world sees them as Black. And if you're Black boys moving from cute, you don't move from cute to, like, I don't know, teenager, you move from cute to threatening. And so I think that not growing up Black in this country, yet raising Black sons, was something that was incredibly eye-opening for me, coming at it from my own biracial lens, coming at it from my own questions of race and identity and belonging, and now seeing very clearly, you know, how my sons were being treated and how my family was being questioned and how I was very concerned for their safety and movements. And in our community, which I live in the Bay Area, it is considered, you know, to be one of the more progressive areas. And yet, you know, they have still been questioned as to whether they live around here. I have still been questioned as to whether I'm their nanny. You know, there's a lot that went unsaid, I think, for a long time until 2016. And when Trump was elected, a lot of what was the undercurrent came out to be very vocal and open, even in these like highly progressive areas, or what people consider to be highly progressive areas. And in that whole time period, I realized, you know, along with my best friend, my co-founder, who's also biracial, that the circles that we move in, And the circles that we were moving in, especially the circles that we were moving in after we had children, which is largely ones of, you know, parents and with children who are doing similar things or schools or whatever, were largely white based on, you know, the areas where we were living. And because we were biracial, we've been able to float through white circles our whole lives, in and out. And what that teaches you is a couple of things. First, that you know what's being said in those circles. Second, you know what's not being said. And third, you know what's being said when people believe that there is no person of color in that space. And I think the third part is also the part that no one says out loud, but we got to experience it. But what we also experienced was in the bucket of things not being said was, you know, the fears that I was having for my own children, because that wasn't a fear shared by the white families in the area. And so I think that all those factors combined led Sarah, my co-founder, and me to think, like, what if we could change the conversation? What if we could take that conversation that has always been around the dominant narrative, the one that we have been taught in school, the one that we, that has been sort of the through line of this country. And what if we could expand that to include so many more experiences than that dominant narrative? And then what if we did that and made communities and groups see what that could change down the line for our children? Because in the end, it is the reason why we started Dear White Women is for our own children, for my children, for my boys, for her girls. And that has been our hope. And you know, from the inception in 2019, through, you know, 5+ years later.
Hey, Kim here. Thanks for being here and learning ways you can build your DEI skills. And it's inevitable that you'll have questions. Maybe you're in an environment where leaders are the challenge. Maybe you're seeing employees become more divided. Maybe your company is getting caught up in the culture wars. Maybe you're just starting in this work and you're not sure what to do. Whatever your biggest challenge is, I've saved some time for us to talk. So set up a one-on-one strategy session by going to communicatelikeyougiveadamnpodcast.com. Very impressive, really, you know, to stay consistent. And what I also read from this consistency is like, you are, I hope that you've seen some movement and change. And I wouldn't be surprised if you said, no, we're still saying the same things 5 years later. But, you know, like, you have faith in a demographic that has been responsible for electing Trump. Over, 54% of white women vote for Trump. It yeah. increased from 2016 to 2020. And that's difficult to grapple with. Because we're voting against ourselves when we do that. We're yeah. voting for somebody who has committed sexual assault, who has done all kinds of things to women. And so that mentality of voting against our own safety and rights and protections is something we need to really internalize and investigate, interrogate within ourselves. Why do we choose to do that? What are we prefacing as more valuable than our own safety and protections and rights? Mm. So what has been that trajectory? And thank you for your faith in our demographic. You know, has the conversation changed much in reaching white women and helping them understand their role in this work?
Yeah, that sometimes my answer changes depending on the day, I will say. But I think overall, you know, I believe that the fact that we are having these conversations more is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I think that it was harder to even have these conversations, right? And I think when I do a lot of work in schools and parent groups and talking to parent groups, especially about how do we talk to our kids about difficult things? How do we talk about race? How do we talk about racism? And I think at the start, especially, and not saying that it doesn't happen today, but a lot of the conversation was centered around, well, I don't want my white child to feel uncomfortable. So I don't want to have these conversations. And I think, you know, the subtext is like, it's not that I don't want my white child to feel uncomfortable. I don't want to feel uncomfortable in trying to figure out how to have this conversation. Right. So I don't want it now, I think, would part the part that keeps me going. But it's still there. I think still whose comfort do we prioritize, right? Whose comfort, and that goes in so many different spheres, right? And so I think we still have a problem with that prioritization and the fact that there is a lack of intentionality, I think, in how we continue to have these conversations. Like, you know, I've donated once, so I don't need to do it again. I had this conversation once, so I don't need to do it again. And I think that's where we lose things. I think that's where, you know, when George Floyd was murdered, everyone, you know, immediately took to social media and proclaimed a lot of stuff. And I think that when you look at that in 2024 and you say, okay, well, how has that come through? I think that that's where I get frustrated because I feel like there is so much that we have, that society as a whole, and in particular white women, have a lot of power in great, really important ways: voting power, wallet power, you know, vocal spaces where people listen, where other there, you know, where white women's voices are heard and other voices may not be, right? Schools and corporations. And if we don't have that intentionality, it really becomes this sort of one and done type thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an ongoing experience for me to find out all the different ways that white women, specifically me, have privilege. My mentor for 20 years now has been a corporate diversity trainer for 40 years. And she's a Black woman out of Los Angeles. She's gay. And when I said, I think I'm going to pivot my career from running internal communication departments in-house within organizations, and I want to strike out on my own and teach other communicators to do this work, how to apply a DEI lens on their communication strategies. And I said, but I won't do it if I'm the wrong person to do it. Like, just recognizing that should a white woman be in DEI communications and being loud about it. I literally, for my birthday, was just given a megaphone. So clearly somebody says that I'm in the right direction. But my mentor literally said, and I checked this out with a variety of people who know me personally, but people who also know me professionally, all women of color. I approached them. I said, should I be doing this? You know, because is this a space that someone who looks like me should be in? And my mentor in particular, they all said, yes, you have to, which is that propels me. And it comes down to something that my mentor told me. She was the first person I asked. And she said, you're going to be in conversations and in rooms that I can't get into. You will be able to have access to people who would not listen to me. And so she's like, you know, inclusion means everybody. It takes everybody because it impacts everybody. So you're part of that everybody. And so that leads me to my second question, which is, what was my third? I don't know. I'm not counting. Is that the last stat that I saw, Misasha? I don't know if you know this, but over 80% of communication roles, that's the last stat. And there might be more updated information. I hope that there is. I hope it's lower, but that at least 80% of professional communicators within organizations are, those roles are taken by people who look like me, men and women, but mostly women. And so, especially if we're running internal or employee communications, what are those downstream effects that you could potentially see when we're the ones that are putting together leader messaging, all hands in town hall messaging, We're writing content for Black History Month, and we shouldn't be, by the way, at Pride, API Heritage Month and stuff. Like a little side note, we should not be writing it. So I'm kind of setting you up for an obvious answer here, but other things like organizational changes, other engagement survey results that we might be talking about internally in organizations. What are those potential downstream effects if the people who are responsible, it's our job to put together communication plans and write copy and content related to our organization that may have an adverse effect on the diversity of our organization?
Yeah, I think that's such an important question because I don't think people think about it enough. And I think, when you come at all of those, the comms work, right? From one narrative, from the narrative that is both happens to be the dominant narrative and your lived experience, right? It is hard to encompass everyone's narrative, right? Because you don't know. And I think that a lot of times it comes through that you, for lack of asking questions of the groups that you're really trying to address, to help, to further, to, and hopefully not speak for, right? You come at it from a singular perspective. And I think that that is damaging because sometimes, and how I've seen it happen is, you want to encompass everyone's feelings, right? Or how you feel everyone will feel or will view this. And so the message comes out in a way that really represents no one, or that there is fear of saying the wrong thing. And so then you stop yourself from saying what needs to be said, right? And that ties into a whole bunch of things like perfectionism, and like back to ignorance and willful ignorance even. I'm just saying ignorance based on what we have been taught to date and how our society has upheld white supremacy and continued to hold that through how we look at everything through these lenses. So I think that it's a disservice to everyone, really. It's not just a disservice to the groups that you're speaking for or the groups that you're trying to represent, but it's a disservice to yourself as well, because it is a narrowly informed viewpoint. And I think that that tends to do more harm, because then groups know when you are trying to speak for them. And groups know when you're missing the mark as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a part of the book that Janet, my co-author, and I talk about is building out this infrastructure. Like if you can't get headcount, what can you do from other means, from relationships internally, externally, building out the infrastructure, having an advisory group that reviews your content that you pre-plan with ahead of time to say, what do you need to be said? So regardless of our identities, if we're holding these positions, we know how to be storytellers. We may own the channels, but if we're not a part of a community that is being, that needs, that deserves this visibility, then that's when we just lean on those skills that we have, but we don't get to lead the content. We don't get to decide what are the four cultural observances. This drives me nuts, me Sasha. Like internal comms people. If you've heard me talk about this on the podcast before, it just drives me bonkers that, that companies will set up, here's a budget to internal comms, choose the four tier one cultural observances that we're going to put branding behind. And you've got some money for swag and wristbands. And I just want to blow all that up and saying that's not the way to go about it. That is just so performative. And so you have at least one episode about performative allyship.
Yes.
So yes. If you wouldn't mind talking about that and relating it to how do we make sure if we're holding these roles and it's our job, what do we need to do to ensure that we are not performative in our allyship and that the content is what it needs to be, the actions that follow the content needs to be what it is, even if we all look like each other on the comms team?
Yeah, I think you have a really great point about an advisory board or, you know, I think one of the biggest things that is left out of communications, and I say this as a lawyer too, because I don't think I was particularly good at this in certain ways, it is listening, right? And is listening and asking the right questions. Because I think when there is a lot of assumptions that go into a lot of things, right? And I think, you know, with the performative allyship, for example, there is a lot of assumptions that, like, I put up this black square on Instagram, right? That is going to be the way that the black community wants me to show up. And that is the way that I show up as an ally. And P.S. I'm done now because I did that. So everyone knows that I'm an ally, like, job done. You
we're
know,
good.
Without, I'm right, right. We're good. Yes. And I think that that, you know, if you are asking questions of the community that you are trying to serve and listening, actually listening to the answers, not just, you know, asking the question and be like, right, I thought you'd say that. Perfect. Let me just put this in here. We're good. And I think also, like, asking more than one person too, because they think that leaving end of that for something like an HPI, you know, Heritage Month, or, you know, I don't speak for all Asian women, nor can I. And I think that sometimes if you feel like you check the box with one person of that group, then you're also done. And I don't think that it's as simple as that. And I think that if we're really working to get the message right, right, and to make it mean something, then we've got to be asking questions. We have to listen to the answers, because you will get, if you come at it from a place of openness too, right, not sort of a confirming place where, like, this is what I think, yes, okay, then we get to the change aspect, right? Then we get to people thinking more broadly about all of us, right, as a community, whether that community is your corporation, whether it is your community, whether it's something else.
Formative allyship, folks, that's a great place to start. And one thing I'll add is this thing that I talk to clients about, and it's called majority coding. And that's C-O-D-I-N-G, not coding like you're wearing a coat because it's cold, but majority coding, like a programmer. And it is like a program.
I like that you clarify that.
That's what we try to do all the time. so we do this work where we have, we see things in a certain way. And if we're really not paying close attention, we're going to steep into this alien language of corporate jargon speak that, to your earlier point, that no one's going to understand. It's not going to mean anything to anybody. And sometimes that's part of the design, which is very disturbing. That does not help with trust if it's a whole bunch of words that don't mean anything. Or it's a bunch of words like a DEI statement, and it sounds really good, but it still doesn't mean anything. We have to stop that as communicators. We have to be the curators and the content creators of stuff that don't mean anything. Like that, I'll put on a wristband. Let's stop creating things that say a lot of things but don't mean anything. So majority coding is something that my mentor taught me through her eyes as a Black woman. She can see between the lines. She can see what's, you know, who's been involved in creating this content, whose perspective it's coming from, and that it's setting this precedent or expectation of how it's to be received by the audiences. And we are missing out, especially as internal communicators, on a lot of perspectives and experiences from our audiences by not incorporating their viewpoints into the work from the beginning. So it's something to look into. I touch on it a little bit in the book. There's another episode I'd like to ask you about. It's one of your most recent, basically because of the timing of when we are recording in March of 2024. It is extremely timely, where you're addressing politics, talking about politics in the workplace. And this is something I deal with clients all the time. Like, we have a CEO that says, you know, we can't talk about politics or religion in the workplace. I immediately go to the dinner table and losing out on 18 years of learning to how to have conversations about religion and politics. So for me to try to say, to be afraid of saying the wrong thing, you know, the things that you were mentioning earlier about how people will shut down these conversations and, you know, by saying, I don't want my son to be uncomfortable about this topic. And it's really just this fight to get back in control of the situation and shut things down so we can stay in our comfort zone. I look at this and I say, well, that's not fair. Let's just at the base level, it's not fair because an organization, a company only exists because of a relationship with the government. You get a license, you have an EIN number, you pay tax, well, maybe not pay taxes, but there's a relationship there with the government. And so there's relationships of why you move your headquarters to a certain state or that you file, you know, your S Corp, C Corp in certain states. There's a relationship there. There's legislation. There's funding, there's laws to protect your industry or further, you know, access to land or water or whatever for your industry. So there's a relationship that is going on that creates the organization to be what it has become. And then to turn around and say, oh, we don't talk about politics in the workplace is so out of integrity. Because you're saying that you get to choose what's being talked about, when it's being talked about, rather than owning the fact that people have to talk about these things, especially post 2020. Me as a gay woman, my identity has been politicized. Me being a cisgender woman has been politicized. So while my identity is what it is, other people have made it political. And so talk about that episode and what you and your co-host talk about there and help us navigate a little bit how to handle these leaders who want to shut it down or when other employees post kind of not so nice things on our internal channels if somebody wants to talk about something or an organization wants to roll out a new health benefit to protect women's reproductive rights of employees in certain states, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the impetus for that episode was, I think, just hearing the phrase like, oh, stop being so political, or you're being, we don't talk about politics, and I have such a fundamental problem with that, kind of along the lines of what you were saying, because what isn't political these days? Like, there isn't really a boundary. I find it very hard to find that because so much of our identity is wrapped up in political decisions that are made for or about us, And I think about Dobbs, right? And I think about, regardless of how you feel about a woman's right to choose, that is bodily autonomy first and foremost. And I think that it is impossible to have a workplace where people are not affected daily by these decisions, by what they are being told about their own identities. And especially this year, right, to chill all communications on that front means that we are heading into a really dangerous period where we may not be able to have those conversations anymore. And so I think that when our first instinct is to say that's too political, like, I think we need to ask more questions around that. Like, well, why is it too political? If it's because, people feel a certain way about something like, I remember back with Dobbs, there were issues around religion and how people being of different religions, how would they feel about that? And I think that the issue is that we have to distill everything down to sort of what does it mean about our own identities and how we show up to work, how we show up for each other. So not So sort of sanitizing those conversations out of the workplace means that we are not able to fully be showing up or not able to really feel safe, right? Feel like we belong, because those topics, right? And I use air quotes for that because, again, what isn't political are being shoved to the side. And I don't think you can only shove things to the side so far before they come back in an explosive way. And so I think, like, why not get out in front of that, acknowledge that these things are out there. Yes, that is part of politics. All of this is political. And so in order to sort of bridge a lot of the divides and bridge a lot of the gaps that we have in society, have in our communities today, we have to be able to talk about them. And in ways that, you know, we acknowledge each other and our own humanity in it. And I think that that is super tricky to do. I do not think it is easy at all, but I think it really does. It is a necessary thing that we can't just leave to chance, right? Or to the families who say, like, okay, we can talk about politics here, because the more that we're taught, it's kind of, I see it similar to talking about race. And maybe our first conversations when we were, you know, talking about someone's race or about racism was, we don't talk about that. And years of not talking about that have not solved anything related to that, right? It has just made it more entrenched and allowed systems to remain in place that really hurt all of us. So it's probably a long-winded answer of, like, I think these are essential conversations.
I completely agree. Okay, friends, we're actually going to pause the conversation right here. I know it is so good and it was really building up momentum. You probably hate me right now, but the conversation when we recorded was so good. We just kept going and going. So we're going to split it in the sake of your time and protecting your time. We're going to split this conversation into two different episodes. So keep a lookout and find the other half and the other part of this conversation with this guest. I know you're going to love it. Okay, so what popped out to you from this conversation? And I mean, it may take a minute to process, but be sure not to brush off what you just heard. Look, you just need a partner to be with you through this experience and understand what to do next. So I'm inviting you to set up a one-on-one strategy session. All you need to do is go to communicatelikeyougiveadamnthepodcast.com and you'll see the button there. The more conscious communicators in the world, the better the world. So thank you for listening. And until next time, let's communicate like we give a damn.